Okay, let's get started because time is getting short. For the past months, I've had multiple requests to do a video of Work is Worship. There is a two-part audio on truthbase.net that I would encourage you to listen to if this topic continues to interest you, and it should. And the reason is I'm only going to do this in one part unless you have a lot of discussion. There's a lot of discussion on the other two. Like how to manage your boss and good stuff like that. So we're going to take a look at it's got better jokes too because they're more relevant back then. We're going to take this a look at 1 Peter chapter 2. And I originally did this back in the early 90s. Wowie. I was going through 1 Peter, and when I hit Chapter 2, verse 18, talking about servants be submissive to your masters. I kind of did an excursus on the subject of work. And so we're also going to be looking at a topical study of work after looking at the top three passages on the subject. So 1 Peter 2:17 says we're supposed to, honor all people, fear the king, respect the king, fear God, and love the brothers. And that's you can look back on the series and find more about that. And then he addresses specifically servants, and he uses a word for servant that is a little different from the other passages that Paul uses. It's more of a household servant. So he's referring to that here, but then Paul re refers to what's known as a bond servant or a slave, which is the more common word. Why the difference? I don't know. You make something up and be happy with whatever you think about. So, servants, be submissive to your masters with all phobia or fear, not only to the good, gentle, kind, nice ones, but also to the harsh. And this is the word for which we get scoliosis, which means twisted and perverse. That most of you have had pointy-haired bosses that really are kind of twisted. They don't, they work across purposes to the company's best interest, across the purpose to their employees' best interest and even their own, but that's what they do. They're at work for all the wrong reasons, but somehow they manage to be your boss. So that's actually your benefit because in that situation you have the opportunity to lay up eternal reward in the midst of that context, which is basically what he goes on to say in verse 19. For this is commendable, this is meritorious, this is praiseworthy, this is actually what the word means, this is rewardable. If because of conscience towards God, you endure grief suffering wrongly. So you're conscious that God gives this command and will reward you for obeying it. And as a result, you endure long suffering grief that you don't deserve. So there's a series that I've done on stupid suffering. This is smart suffering. You do what's right and you suffer for it. So the concept of commendable is elaborated upon when he gets down here in verse 20. What credit, what benefit, what profit is it to you if when you're beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? So back in the day, you didn't just get a bad review, you got beaten for a review. This. But when you do good and suffer, that's a thing? Yeah. You do good and you suffer. You take it patiently, which implies you're getting beaten again. This is commendable before God. So we're talking about doing what is commendable, meritorious before God. And this is really a mindset that you need in order to have the correct response to the crazy things that happen in the workplace. And we're going to take a look at Paul in his two letters, Ephesians and Colossians, where he addresses not the household servant, but your basic slave, bondservant. So I guess at this point it's kind of legitimate to ask the question. So is a bondservant the same thing as an employee? Do you really have a choice in the matter? They didn't. So on the other tape, I talk about Victor or Vinny, the vomitorium cleaner-upper. So his job was to clean up place where people went during the orgies to throw up so they could eat more, the original bulimics. And he was able to, if you were a Christian, you didn't have a choice of saying, I'd like to put in for a transfer, please. Or, you didn't go talk to the, vomitorium cleaner up or headhunter and say, got anything else out there that's a little more pleasant? You couldn't do that. So you had to draw on God's grace to endure bad situations. And later on down, we're going to talk about how God uses your job to refine you. But here's a thought I'd like to plant in your thinking, that you have a choice as to where you work. And we're going to look at jobs as things that are given to us by God, and recognizing that it's His will for us to be in the situations that we're in. And in doing things according to His will, what's necessary for getting blessed, you really have a choice. And if you come to the realizations, I cannot obey God in this situation, you can leave. But if you're going to stay there, then you need to do it God's way. So it's a choice that you make right up front. Okay, God gave me this job. I'm going to do it for God's glory. I'm going to do it for God's reward with the grace that God provides. And if you kind of put that stark decision before you, like, either I do it God's way or I leave, most of you would actually stay and try to do it God's way, because leaving is kind of a scary proposition. Back then, they didn't have that option. They were stuck, and they had to draw on God's grace. Think about it. You're getting beaten for doing what is right, and you're stuck there. You kind of need to be able to draw on God's grace to endure that situation. So in Ephesians 6:5, not to 95, typo there, you probably figured that out. Bondservants, be obedient. Submissive is another way of translating that. To those who are your masters according to the flesh. And then he elaborates how you're supposed to be obedient. With fear and trembling. Wow, we got phobia and shaking. In sincerity of heart, as if your master were Christ. Wow. That's a pretty tall order. Not with eye service, basically when their eye is on upon you, not as a man pleaser, but as bond servants of Christ. So you're working for a firm, but your master is really Christ. And in being obedient with fear and trembling, even when they're not watching, you are doing the will of God from the heart. And the asterisk goes to the passage you'll see in a minute on God provides all you need to be able to do His will. So back in the day, you were stuck cleaning up the vomitorium or whatever other unpleasant tasks you had, and you were supposed to serve your pointy-haired boss as if you were serving Christ. And one of the questions that's been asked down below is, if Christ were your actually immediate direct boss, would your work be any different? And most of us would probably say, yeah, of course. He's not a pointy-haired boss, but that's not what we're told to do. We're supposed to do it, even if he is a crooked or perverse one. So, with goodwill, doing service, again, as to the Lord and not to men. And on the other tape, I tell the story of one of my professors who was on American Airlines, who's part of their Admiral's Club, and he is observing this flight attendant doing a superb job dealing with a drunk who flight was delayed. They give free drinks. People get really nasty. And he went up to her asking for her name, saying he was part of the Admiral's Club and he wanted to commend her to American Airlines. And she said, not knowing who he was, oh, I don't work for American Airlines. His first thought was, oh no, I'm on the wrong flight. And then she says, I'm a Christian and I work for the Lord Jesus. And that should kind of be our mindset and possibly our witness, that we are working on doing God's service from the heart. The key to this is found in verses 8 and 9, knowing. Knowing the way you're able to do the will of God for your heart, even in the midst of really difficult circumstances, is that whatever good you do, you're going to receive the same, which is good, from the Lord. And it doesn't matter if you're slave or free. So God will pay you back, both good and bad. That's a major theme in Scripture that somehow people seem to miss, but it's all over the place if you read your Bible. And you masters do the same things to them. In other words, do good to them, your employees, giving up threatening, knowing that your own master also is in heaven and there's no partiality with him. So verse 8 is the positive side. Verse 9 is kind of the negative side. God will judge justly. People seem to have lost sight of that. Oh yeah, his justice was all satisfied with Jesus dying on the cross, and now we just live as we please. And you know that's folly and ridiculousness. Same idea is in Colossians 3:22. Bondservants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers. Okay, he said that just up above, so copy this over. But in sincerity of heart, because you fear God. And whatever you do, whatever, do it heartily as for the Lord rather than for men, knowing that from the Lord you'll receive the reward of the inheritance. It is Christ whom you serve on your job. So if we have this attitude that, you know, the one that we're serving is the one who not only has done so much for us, but the one who wants to do even more for us in terms of short-term grace and eternal grace, then it will enable us to work heartily, to endure unjust treatment, to basically be Christ-like in the way in which we work. And I can't pass by this passage right here, verse 24. Reward is equated with inheritance. And there's so many false teachers that say, oh, inheritance, it's all guaranteed. No, 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 you can lose it. Just look at what happened with the nation of Israel. And right here, inheritance is equated with a reward. And I know all of you know that, so I don't have to spend much more time on it. Any questions on these three verses? All right, these are generic servants. The one in Peter was a household servant and oikos servant. So these two passages are your basic bond servant. You, it's sometimes translated slave in this context. It's sometimes was a indentured servant where you had sold yourself to pay your debts, and then in the Jewish back custom, you were let free every 7 years. So it's sometimes slave, sometimes or indentured servant would be a good modern translation. This refers to people who, by and large, did not have the option of leaving. So that is, I think, the only differentiation between us modern employees and time back then. Did that answer your question? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, the question was, these bond servants, domestic household servants, and the answer was no. These are your basic bond servant, and that's it. Right. The principle is the thing that applies, and as I mentioned at the start of this, it, you know, if you're going to be working, this, you do your work as to the Lord. It just, you know, there's other passages if you are like an entrepreneur or an independent business person that you have to treat justly and give full measure and things like that. But most of us are in context of we're serving in a specific location. So if you're going to be working there, work there. Do it heartily. Okay, yes, I'm going to be looking at those down below, but one of the real good basic foundational fundamental approach is in your quiet time, pray through your to-do list and ask God for help before you get into the work. Think about what situations are coming up. And then as those situations come up, since you've already kind of planted it in your robot that morning that this is something that you're going to need God's help with, then you can be looking for his help. And then I'm going to be talking about Lord of My Pots and Pans a little later, called Practice of the Presence of God, where you want to develop a kind of running dialogue of as you start each task, or as even as you're in the midst of each task, one of the questions you should be asking yourself in the middle of the task is, am I doing this to the correct standard? Do I need to stop, or do I need to put more effort in? And then as you begin each new task, you know, it takes, you know, less than a second to have the thought of, God, help me with this, guide me in this, help them answer the phone, give me favor in their sight. There are a lot of these, you know, half a second prayers that you can be engaging in. And I got this idea way back when from a book that I was going to mention later, but I'll do it now. Practice of the Presence of God. There was a monk or a brother of a religious order who really wasn't cut out to be in the religious order, so he constantly had kitchen patrol, you know, basically gave him the worst task. And one of the reasons why people joined these religious orders was to be able to focus more on God. And funny thing is, what they wind up doing is they're farming and they're, you know, feeding and they're doing a lot of manual work. And he actually wrote a little prayer called Lord of My Pots and Pans. And he realized that, you know, he could be doing his work and praying as he's doing it. And it that kind of helped jive in my mind the idea of pray without ceasing, that as you're going through the things that you do, you're asking God for help. And you go through your day with a power assist. When you lose sight of that, you kind of get overwhelmed by the, you know, ankle biters and nose nippers and all those other things that the Good Shepherd kind of removes out of your way. So those are just two. We're going to actually hit on more a little later. So I'll defer that until later. Okay, there was another question. You answered your own question. Oh, good. Self-edifying. I like it. Everybody else take note. You just keep doing this and yeah, we'll be fine. All right. Sure. Right. There are other areas that God wants you to serve. You don't give all your life to your work, because in order to do your work so that God rewards it, it's got to be done in balance. Because if you're neglecting some of the stuff that God has commanded you to do, to give all your life to your job, which we're going to see in 2 minutes, then God's not going to be pleased. In fact, the ability to enjoy your work only comes from those who please God. So then the bigger question becomes, how do you please God? Which we're getting to. Okay. So here's the asterisk where God is able to make all grace abound towards you, that you, always having all sufficiency in all things, may have an abundance of what you need for every good work. That includes time, money, you know, those are two biggies, personnel. God basically is able to make that happen. If we really believe that he is the sovereign controller of the universe who upholds all things by the word of his power, then we basically need to come to this perspective of, well, he's got all this grace, all this power, then why am I in a point of need? And you look at Paul's life, and he knew how to suffer need and yet be content. So you have the eventually you come to this realization of, okay, God is able to make all grace abound to me. He will give me what I need when I need, but maybe there's something in the meantime that I need to do until he provides that which I seek. And one of the toughest things is the waiting on God, which is a favorite activity of the saints of old, where you have to develop the endurance, the long suffering, the, you know, the patience, the characteristics that Job and Joseph had to go through. Because that was ultimately what glorified God, but you didn't really see it until the end. And Hebrews 11 says, none of these guys actually received what was promised. God's got some better plan for when actually everything comes to fulfillment. Little differentiation between play and work. It says that Americans worship their work, they work at their play, and they play at their worship. And I guess you could also say that's true of some other cultures as well. And the reason that they worship their work is because work meets all their needs. It meets their needs for food. It meets their needs for rent. It meets their needs for pleasure. It meets their needs for security. It meets their needs for significance. All those things are needs that God is supposed to meet. And by looking to something else besides God for meeting those needs, we are engaging in idolatry. And that's not a good thing. God particularly gets ticked off when we engage in idolatry. So play is effort expended voluntarily in the expectation of an inconsequential reward. So play is something you don't have to do. It's something that you want to do. But what you get out of it is basically short-term gratification. It doesn't really last. It's not that enduring. I guess you're supposed to do your play as unto the Lord as well, because whatever you do it for the glory of God. Work, on the other hand, is effort that's expended usually under compulsion. That is why they pay you. If you loved everything about your job, you would have to pay them to do it because, oh, this is so much fun. But work is labor, it's sweat. And in order to get you to do the stuff you don't like, they have to pay you. I remember I'd written out my first syllabus when I was first starting at the university. And I was probably a little more idealistic. And I was talking about the grading structure. And I was talking about what an A student was like. And I said, "You're the reason why I teach." And then the person who was coordinating it sent me back a note saying, "Well, what about the B and C students?" And I wrote back, "That's why you pay me to teach." So, and the D's and the F's, as well. So, work is effort expended usually under compulsion and the expectation of reward of significance or vital consequence, like, food, drink, place to sleep out of the cold, stuff like that. And one of the ethics that we tried to cultivate in our children as they were growing up was a work ethic. We don't want to grow up to be spoiled brats. And so we would actually work on digging and stuff up in the mountains. And then, they're there kind of dropping, "Oh, I'm so tired." And then I say, "Okay, you guys can go play." And then they go and they put much more effort into their play, which is like, and it's kind of universal that if you're excited about doing something, then it's not as much effort to do the thing that you're excited about because emotions enter into it in a positive way. Emotions can enter into things in a negative way where, "Oh, I hate this. I can't believe this. Oh, why he's such a pointy-haired boss. My coworker's just like Wally and Dilbert. I mean, it's just like horrible, horrible, horrible." And that saps our strength. But if you are realizing, "I am serving the Lord in doing that, and the Lord is pleased with me, and the Lord's going to help me, and if things don't go the way I want, God's going to bless me even more in the future," then that actually creates a positive emotion towards doing the job because you know that you're pleasing to God in the process of doing it. A couple weeks I'll probably do a little something on the concept of emotion, but emotion is something that moves you to motion. And the things that we tend to like doing, you come home and you're really dragging, and then someone says, "Oh, you want to go do this? Oh, yeah, let's go do that." And all of a sudden, like you perk up and the emotions flow, and you get all those endorphins running, and you just kind of charge it after the thing that you enjoy. Well, work, when we recognize that it's something God gave us for our benefit, should engender some of those positive emotions. Not as many, but it should go for some. Okay, a little acrostic that I really think you should try to carry around in your head to help you remember. Work is worship, and it's also witness if done with the right motives and attitudes. So, does that mean we're supposed to whistle while we work or sing while we work? Well, no, worship is not singing and whistling, contrary to much of contemporary Christendom. Although you could kind of hum a little bit under your breath, it might not be bad. But worship is a response to revelation. So if you go on Daily Truth Base, Genesis 22, first spot it's mentioned, I do a little blurb and direct you to some other resources. If you don't understand that worship is response to revelation, then you need to go, kind of go back there and cement down this principle. And work is worship because if worship is response to revelation and God commands us to do our work a certain way, like 6 days thou shalt labor, then when I do my labor because God said it, then it becomes worship. I'm responding to revelation. When I serve my pointy-haired boss who's asking for unreasonable things as if I was serving the Lord, I am engaging in worship. And worship is what you do to get blessed. It's not just, a thing you do because, it says worship. You always worship the gods to get something from them, which is blessing, fertility for your herds or your crops or protection from your enemies, abundant, in your vineyard, good stuff like that. So work, we're told, to do it as unto the Lord. It's a form of worship. Okay, any questions on that one? Okay, your work is worship just as much as singing songs on Sunday. Okay, work is ordained. It spells work, by the way, for those of you who are acrostically challenged. Ordained by God for our benefit. All right, 6 days you shall labor. But all of God's commands are for our benefit. He did not give us commands, according to Exodus 20, verse 9, to make our life miserable, but to make it good. And just because we can't have some things that we want, we think, oh, God hates me. No, he loves you. That's why he basically has put some boundaries or restrictions. It's what's best. So if God has ordained that men should work and women should work, then it's a good thing because it comes from the hand of a good God. So most people, we actually saw it in a song, we'll work till Jesus comes, I'll lay my armor down, and then I'll just live happily ever after. Well, okay, that's a nice thought, but let's look at life before the fall. What did Adam do before he sinned and got kicked out of the garden? He named all the animals. He also tended a garden that was bounded by four rivers. Big garden. He was created to do work. God gave him a job before he sinned. After he sinned, work became more difficult, but it was a thing designed by God for his benefit before the fall. Guess what we do when Jesus comes back? We work. We actually still, if you notice the book of Revelation, and actually Isaiah, talking about the millennial kingdom, you plant crops, you harvest vineyards, you make wine. I guess you could also make micro beer. and cider, I'm sure, you know. Garden of Eden cider. Ah, right, okay. Fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So, we're going to be working in the future. There are priests who are working in Ezekiel 45 in the millennial temple. They're still carrying the firewood. They're still cutting up the sacrifices. They're still bringing the blood into the Holy of Holies. There is work that we are made for. We serve Christ. Ruling, I believe, requires work. Sorry to pull the rug out from under your feet, but okay, you got to eat. Manna is not going to happen. Someone's got to plant. Someone's got to harvest. Somebody has to, you know, grow stuff to give. And somebody's got to come up with the lambs. Rest is cessation of hostilities. So you no longer have the fear of, like, you're working in the days of Nehemiah. You have a shovel in one hand and a sword in another. You don't have the threat of invasion, which most of the world lives under. You don't have the threat of unjust government. So there's a peace that's there. Just think about sheep following the good shepherd. They still have to do sheep work. What sheep work? Well, you have to stay by the shepherd and you have to eat grass and grow fat so they can, you know, eventually sacrifice you. Right, the angels actually go out and do your weeding. I mean, at the beginning of the kingdom, they pull all the weeds out of the kingdom. The sun is always there. The water is there. You don't have to worry about drought. You don't have to irrigate. So it's going to be a good, productive land. And there is time to sit in your vineyard under your fig tree and sip wine and munch figs and biscuits of some sort, I guess. And it's all gluten-free, so it's all good. Okay, you'll have a body that doesn't kind of have food in. Yeah, broccoli is going to taste like chocolate, guaranteed. And you don't have to make disciples. let's see. No, actually, you still have. There is going to still be some ministry, and you actually, if you are ruling, you have to get, you know, hike to the or fly to the holy city to get the tree of. The leaves from the tree of life for healing for the nations that you're ruling over. So they still work, but it's in the joyful service of the Lord because he's gonna supernaturally do it. And winemaking, totally. Okay, R, work is rewarding and rewarded if done biblically. So you get two paychecks, one from your earthly boss and one from your heavenly boss. And, you know, we hear in our praise time how God manages to bless his people disproportionately, I think, to the amount of work that they do. And we're going to look at Ecclesiastes, mention that Solomon, reflecting on all of life, says there's nothing better for a person than to eat, drink, and find pleasure in their work. But this is a gift from the hand of God that he only gives to those who please him. So if you start out with a job and, oh, it's just wonderful and great, and then it becomes really miserable, you might want to first ask the question, am I pleasing to God? Am I putting too much emphasis on my work and on neglecting my relationship with God? Or is this just part of God's plan to refine, polish, and bless me? So we'll look a little bit on that down below. And yes, I did misspell consists. work consists of serving and others' needs. All right. So work is a form of service. And once you understand this, it will put a perspective on what you do that's important. You know, you go into a restaurant, the people who wait on you and cook for you are serving your need for hunger. When I teach my students at the university, I am meeting a couple of their needs. One is their need for getting a credit so they can graduate. And the bigger need is for knowledge. And the thing which they never quite seem to grasp is I'm actually trying to build into their lives the discipline that they're going to need on the job. Like, there's a boss who has an objective and a deadline. He expects you to hit it and to pay attention to what he said. Who knew? That's supposed to go on? Yeah, it's like the last years I was teaching, this was like totally over the student's head. They didn't quite grasp this thing that, yeah, they're going to pay you, but only for doing what they say. So you need to listen to pay attention, and you can start right here in this class. You get a head start on your contemporaries. So you might want to think about what kind of work you do and how that is actually serving someone's needs. and it will help you actually expand your usefulness. If you want to basically increase your paycheck, increase your capacity for service. And people who train themselves to do, you know, more useful things usually can wind up getting better jobs. People who are just kind of stuck working on a factory assembly line, and I did assemble autos one summer when I was in college. It just led to mind-numbing drug use. Not personally, of course, but the psychiatrist for the largest assembly plant under one roof in the world at the time lived across the street from me, and I used to play tennis with him. And I saw him at some Christmas gathering multiple years later, and I talked about the fact that the plant had shut down. And they used to give the college kids a little overtime to kind of clean up the line, and knowing that we were hungry, we would be, that's why they picked us. And we also were at a lower pay scale than everybody else. But you'd go out, and the entire parking lot, acres and acres and acres, would just be full of beer cans and bottles. We didn't have to clean up those things. We just, clean up was you took an air gun and you blew down the line and blew everything else, and somewhere else picked it up. But guys would go out to their cars and get high, and then the productivity of that plant plummeted because the workers were, just not caring. And it was thinking that they had this great technological advancement, but it fell apart because the workers weren't engaged in doing things heartily. And it's kind of hard to be engaged when you're doing the same repetitive thing where you're just basically a machine. I kind of learned to think, and as I worked on other things very much during that time, to keep my sanity, because I actually couldn't afford to get high as much as I would have liked. Okay. So work consists of serving others' needs. Any questions on these four items? Okay, can I talk about how motives and attitudes are connected? You can have the right motives, but the attitude doesn't always follow. And that's because you need to link them better in your mind. So your motive is to serve God. And then if you look at some of the characteristics of how you are supposed to serve God, it's with a good attitude, not just do the minimum to get by. If you actually believe that I am doing this for God's glory, I'm doing this so God looks good, I'm doing this so God can bless me, then your attitude is going to be more positive, as opposed to, oh man, I thought I was just all finished and now they put this other work on me and oh, that's really bad. If you have grasped this principle, it's like, okay, but God allowed it for my benefit. So you have to, always go back to God is in control. This is for your benefit. Satan might have meant it for evil. Other people might have meant it for evil, but God means it for good. Okay, what do I have to do to get blessed in this situation? And then you realize, it's not exactly what I wanted to do. But eventually you realize that, okay, God's going to judge me for my attitude. And counting things all joy is a thing you do in the midst of suffering. So I got to figure out how to do that. So the sermon on counting all joy would probably be helpful. Someday in the future, I'll talk more about motives and attitudes. Okay, so here are some ways that you can apply some of these four little principles that we just talked about and the verses up above. So, do I obey my boss's explicit instructions? So, if they tell me to do something, do I actually do it? And I had some jobs that I just was horribly, poorly suited for. I was assistant to a controller. It's like adding up numbers and it's just entering stuff in ledgers. It was like so boring. But I did it mainly because I needed to earn my tuition. And eventually I was able I was setting up accounting systems, but I still hated accounting. It's just like it's just not my thing. It's I'm an NP, not an SJ. SJs are really good at doing the number things. SNPs, it's really draining. But not just explicit instructions, but I understand what my boss wants so I can follow their implicit desires. So implicit means it's buried within the bigger explicit instructions. Do I understand the reasoning behind why I'm being told what I need to do? And do I do that to a degree that delights him or her? So there's often a contrast between your boss's objectives and the corporation's objectives. And you need to kind of figure out, with God's help, which do you actually do? So if your boss is asking you to lie, you need to kind of be creative in ways to not have to do that and not damage the relationship with your boss. So there's an article that was on Pocket this week about a Google engineer who left their job. What? They left their job? That's like the plum of all the techie people. Wow, worked for Google as an engineer. And it's really worthwhile going on Pocket and finding it. If you can't find it, send me a note and I'll email it to you. But the guy sounded like a phenomenal employee. He would help out other coworkers for their jobs. He would work on his jobs. He would do more than was asked on his jobs. He would get an assignment, and he realized all this code was bad. And rather than just try to put another Microsoft-type patch on it, he got off-the-shelf products to plug it in, cleaned it up, and then they would transfer it out to outsource it to India. And then he would get a new project. And then when compensation time came around, and this is, I think, a real flaw on Google, they're going to be losing more employees if they don't mend their ways. The people who evaluated whether or not he would get a raise or a promotion were not the people who worked with him, not his direct boss. It was an anonymous group of people that had some objectives that they didn't say what it was. So, being a smart guy, he actually figured out what the objectives were and then decided, after getting passed over a number of times, that he would only do what contributed to his review. Now, in one sense, this is a bad objective for his work. But he's also not there for charity. He's there to actually get promoted and become a senior software engineer. So he goes through, only doing that. He doesn't help others. He doesn't seek to advance the corporate objectives. Only the things that he knows this anonymous group of people are looking for, which is hitting a deadline and getting a project completed, which kind of tells you that a lot of the people who are doing this are SJ software engineers, not people who know how to manage. And the fact that they kept transferring his projects overseas when he's, basically gets them cleaned up, and then before he can get that actually finished, it gets sent over to India. That didn't enter into the equation. So he eventually wound up leaving because he said, "This is ridiculous. They're not taking into account that they took my work away from me." And the last 6 months that he was there, they said, "Your work is really good. You're on track to get a promotion, but we need to see a little longer track record." And he's there, "Well, but you guys keep transferring my jobs away from me, so you can't bring them to completion." "I'm sorry. Try better hard next time." It's like, wow. So you need to keep in mind the corporate objectives, but you also need to keep in mind who actually signs your paycheck. And you need to keep in mind who signs your eternal paycheck. So we're not saying this is easy, but it's like you do need to kind of ask for God's wisdom on what do you do. And I'll talk later on the second tape on this series on when your boss gives you more work than that can be done. You have to learn how to manage your boss. There are some books and articles on it. Just Google how to manage your boss. One of the things that, excuse me, you can do is you can go to your boss and communicate and say, "It looks like it's going to take me longer to do this than I have the resources to do it. Which is a higher priority?" "Oh, they're both priorities." "Okay, well, if I have to do both of them, I'm not going to be able to do them both to the standard that I'm used to doing it and that you're used to, because there just is not enough time and dependent on so many other factors. What would you like me to do?" "Well, just get it all done." So now you've got a pointy-haired boss who's not open to reason, but you basically ask God then, "God, what do you want me to do?" And if you were back in the Roman day, you would basically risk getting beaten for doing what was right. And you basically have to still kind of figure out, how do I hit this objective? Pray for God to provide help, and he'll come to your rescue if your ways are pleasing to him. "Are my motives pure in working? Am I serving Christ or self?" And most people are serving themselves. That's the default. They want their own advancement, their own pleasure, their own power. They're not serving Christ. "Do I work as hard as when he's gone as when he's hovering over my desk?" And we all know when the cat's away, the mice will play. Squeak, squeak. So it's what we do. We basically need to keep focused on the task. But then you also need to realize that being able to do your task well is dependent on having good relationship with your coworkers. So there is this social interaction more, I mean, incredible. So I did this first back in the yuppie generation, where everybody was, just striving for their own personal excellence. Now people are striving for, relational acceptance. And you do want to use your work as a sphere for ministry, and there's a balance. And I'm not saying it's easy, but you do want to have a balance. "Am I perceived as a servant of Christ? Do people know you're a believer? Do they know that that's why you do what you do?" I remember once, my first job's out of college, I was driving along with the accountant of our firm, and he was a kid who had just been, he was a basketball player, and the president of the company liked basketball players from Syracuse University. So he hired him, and we were traveling to some client, and some guy cut me off. And I just, kind of swerved and avoid him. And this guy who was a, star sports player said, "Wow, you never lose it." I said, What do you mean?" He said, "That guy cut you off and you didn't honk your horn and get mad at him." Of course, when I got older, I kind of got the demo. But who know that he was looking to see how I was going to respond to someone cutting me off? Do I please men so they like me, or do I please Christ so he'll reward me? Unfortunately, sometimes this is a choice you have to make. Sometimes one or the other. The wise saint, the faithful saint, will work on pleasing Christ and trust that, he will protect you. Number six, boy, this is boldface, big letters. What does this mean? Do I embrace my work as the will of God? Goes back to that asterisk. He'll supply all you need to do his will. So I think every person I know has prayed for the job they've got. Remember when you were there, you were saying, asking God, "Give me the job. I pray you give this to me." God gave you the job. In my mind, that becomes God's will for you. And it should be in your mind as well. And then when you want to change, you should be changing because it's God's will. And through the decades, I've talked to people, lots of people like to leave their jobs. We can talk about. It's like that's been the major battle my entire life. It's like, really, it's like, I kid you not, it was a daily battle back in the day, but now it becomes a little less frequent. But I asked God for this, and God provided. So this is what God wants me to do. Why would I think that has changed? And that's not to say there's no reason to change. There are good, valid reasons to change, particularly if your work is subsuming more than it's profitable spiritually. You should be embracing the thing that God has given you as the will of God, be it parenting or any other job. This is God's will. It's His will for me to do it a certain way, as He has specified, and do it in such a way that I need to draw on His grace and become closer and more dependent on Him. And like when you've got to study and your boss dumps more work on your desk just when you're about to leave, you need to pray, God help, what do I do? What do I say? And that deepens your relationship with God. And He uses our work to develop us. My whole heart and whole soul in my service, do I exude an attractive attitude of cheerful goodwill, even in the midst of difficulties? Do I view my work as loving service? And am I conscious of earning Christ's reward as I toll? These are just ways of evaluating your current work situation. Okay, any questions on these? I suspect I'm going to go over to a second sermon on this just like last time. Yeah, wrong reasons for working, these are really good to touch on. And right reasons for working, and yeah, it's like I don't want to cram it in. So, any questions on. Any of these items on these 10?
You talked about balance, but how do I know, like, there's harvest time, so how do I know, like, I'm at a super busy time at work, but how do I know how long that should last and when I'm really out of balance?
Okay, until the spring rains come. So, what you described is there are times in an agrarian society when you have to plow the ground and get the seed in before the rains come. And then there's also times when you have to harvest before the rain ruins it or the bandits come. So there are seasons when you put huge amount of effort in, and then there's times to balance it out. Unfortunately, since the assembly line, it's like, okay, we have to work really hard to hit our deadline, and okay, now we got our next deadline, and now the powers that be have raised our deadline, they expect more, and it's just like, can we get blood out of a stone? And they're going to have to give an account to God for that basically mismanagement and misuse of their employees. But how do you know when you need to kind of give some pushback? So I think there's a little bit of a difference between one-offs, the deadline, and then that's the normal order of work where it's like, let's just use our employees until we wring every bit of life out of them, toss them aside and get new ones, get some fresh meat and do the same thing. So there are people who, if you're in that situation, it's a good situation to get out of when you have no time for a life. Now the question was specifically, how do I know how long it's supposed to last? And the answer is, I don't know. But God does. So you kind of step back and look at, what's been going on for the past month or two? Is this a project that kind of needed to be put together and sold or serviced? Or is it a temporary thing until we hire new help? Lots of people are short-staffed, but we don't want to hire more staff until we have more business coming in. Otherwise, it affects our unemployment insurance and some other things. So you kind of need to be asking God. I'm a big believer in asking God for help in working smarter rather than harder. And most advances in business and services and even projects that you work on come from having insight into better ways to do it. And the problem is, those insights normally don't come when you're in the midst of fighting battles. You need reflective time. So you kind of need to be thinking, okay, get your a quiet time in there and ask God, is there some way to make this faster, go go smoother. And we've had testimonies in our praise time of God just taking projects off people's plate. The client walked away from the deal. Thing got postponed by some other powers. You can be praying for God to create better balance, but if you're praying for that and it now has become a endemic thing where it's not never going to change, I do a thing in toil, and I think it's actually on the tape of the seminar, where I talk about five different ways to evaluate your job. And it's got, you know, the income, it might not meet your needs now, but after your training, it could go up. So what you see going in is not always what you get further down the road. The environment, it's like in a horrible warehouse, but they're moving. Or the coworkers, there's some really horrible, horrible people here, but they said they're going to clean house. So the workload is really bad because they're short-staffed, and then they have plans to hire. You kind of got to do some of your due diligence, ask God to give you insight into when things might change, and then the steps of a good man or woman are ordered by the Lord. You kind of want to ask God, is this where you want me to be serving you or not? And a lot of times we don't want to let go of a job because, I might not get another one, or too many perks on this one, or I have a friend I know pretty well that basically hates their job, but they would lose too much money to leave. So they just go to collect their paycheck, and they don't enjoy their paycheck because they're too busy collecting their paycheck. And it's just, they kind of fail to recognize that if their ways please God, He would give them the ability to enjoy their work. So we didn't get to that, and I really want to spend time on that. So that's why I'll do this again next week. You have to be pleasing God for Him to be able to give you the ability to enjoy the fruits of your labor as well as your actual labor. It's a theme repeated multiple times in Ecclesiastes, which is a pretty good book on work. Other thoughts on that question about how do you know when it's time to jump ship or jump overboard and swim for it? Yeah, they will basically load work on work on work on work on the producers, and they won't manage the people who are non-producing. And then dropping balls deliberately probably is good to talk with them, so there's good communication. Because if you were in their shoes, you would want the employee to actually push back even though you wouldn't like it, rather than risk losing them. Now, the thing that's really interesting, I think I read the statistic, 60% of the work is now that's being done is being done by people who get 1099s, contract employees. More and more work is being done on a, for lack of a better word, freelance basis. And if your boss is putting too much work on you, you might want to consider working as a contractor as opposed to an employee, because then you have a little more control over your life. You didn't have that option back in the day, but now it's actually a thing. You didn't have the option to work at home, but now people are doing that. In fact, some people are encouraging it. It used to be a thing where companies would basically put people on salary so they wouldn't have to pay them overtime. And the person is basically chasing the carrot, but they realize that the stick is attached to their backpack and the carrot is always going to be out of reach as they do that pursuit to the corner of our office. And in the other tape, I talk about you want to try to increase your position of influence, and it is worth working to get into a position of being able to influence people. But I was talking with one of my college roommates, and he said, I was an engineer. I went to work. I got an MBA, so I'd get in management. Got in management. I realized I hated working with people, so I went back to being an engineer. And then he was just telling me yesterday, I was asking if he was going to retire, because we're all in the 65 age group. And he said, my dad worked until he was 75, so he said, I kind of think we're like melons and squash. I'm thinking, oh boy, this is going to be a good one. So this is an engineer's attempt at being philosophical. And he said, I grow melons and squash, and I know that if you keep, picking them, they keep growing. And if you let them go to seed, and you know, they basically send some hormones back, and the plant knows it's time to die off to make room for the new seeds to grow. And he says, I feel like we're kind of like that. So he wants to basically keep working, not send any signals back that it's time to die off and make room for someone else to breathe the air that you're breathing on Earth. It's kind of sad. Anyway, working as a contractor is an option that people have that you didn't have in the past that is sometimes worth exploring and even angling towards, because it gives you some more freedom, and then you're going to be responsible for how you use your freedom. Last questions? Yes, go ahead. Yes. Okay, so if your boss wants you to do things 80-20, but his implicit desire is for you to do things perfectly, then there's this thing that goes on called communication, where you actually have to talk to them about saying, I've noticed that this comes up. You have said you wanted me to do things 80-20, and I've been trying to figure out, you know, what's the 20% that can be left undone, because I don't want you to have to come back and nail me for the 20. It will save us both time if we can figure that out. Now, before you say that, you need to figure out what 20% you think could be not done. So you have to kind of figure out that standard and then propose it to him that, you know, you want normally, you know, I would like to do this, you know, 100%, but I don't have that amount of time. And you know, I don't have that time, and you don't want me to spend that time. So this is the part I was thinking it didn't have to be done, you know, to such a standard. I remember someone lined up a consulting job for me on time and life management, and it was this manager for a PR firm that was complaining that they were spending all their nights at work until 11 o'clock. So I said, well, what are you doing until 11 o'clock? And she says, I'm redoing my subordinates' work. And I said, why are you redoing your subordinates' work? Well, because it's not how I would do it. And I said, well, does the client want it done to that standard? No. Does your boss want it done to that standard? No. So I said, well, you're really not staying to do work. You're staying to do your hobby. because you are getting pleasure out of showing yourself to be better than your employees. It's not something that has to be done. You're just choosing to do this because you're working out your issues of worth and value. Of course, I do not suggest you ever talk to your boss like that. But I do suggest that you kind of try to figure out, okay, this is, look at what's on your plate, pray, ask God for wisdom about what's the most important pieces. And if you kind of train yourself to figure out what's the most important piece and you kind of cut that swath out, then you can kind of then see which of the stuff that's remaining gets the extra time. And that requires planning your work, as opposed to just jumping in and doing something. So being a little perceiver-esque in trying to figure out what's the most important piece of this will actually help you work smarter. Because of my natural tendencies, I always try to figure out what's the key piece that has to be done and how much of the undone stuff do I actually have to do. And then frequently God will just make it so that piece is unimportant, or if it's important, he'll give me the extra oomph to do it. And when God is giving me my oomph, I think that's an Irish word for grace. I'm just amazed how stuff flows. And when I'm not having that, it's just like, oh, it's torture. But communication is probably really good. And if you basically communicate to your boss that you want to do what they want in such a way that you're both happy, then if you have that right attitude, that'll come across, as opposed to someone who's complaining, not wanting to do anything. Your objective is to want to please them. And he should appreciate that if he's a decent boss. So, well, the thought is when you're at work, you do your work heartily. And then there's times when you're not at work. We're going to talk more about the whole thing about balance again next time, because it is a balancing act. Yuck, 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 yuck. Okay, our time's up. Let's pray. Yes. Sure. Go ahead. Okay, I'll address that next week, but just to give you something to think about it, back in the day, there was no ministry work. So, and in the future kingdom, there's really not ministry work. The guy who is cutting firewood in the millennial kingdom is doing that so sacrifices can be offered. The guy who's growing sheep or raising sheep is doing that so God can be glorified through that. So, just the logical extension, if you do revelation, reason, reality, the reality is if everyone was doing missionary work, how would things survive? And we're not told to do that. We have a couple of examples of Jesus specifically calling some people for purposes to be an apostle, but the commands that you see later on unfolding in the New Testament are the commands that we have here, to do your work heartily as unto the Lord. So we'll address that more. It actually shows up in right and wrong reasons for working. And good question. I guess we do have to do a part two. Okay, let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you that you are a God who is one who works, that on 6 days you labored on creation, and on the seventh day you rested, and you are laboring now through the millennia of working out your purposes on earth according to your timetable, and there will become a time when we will enter into your Sabbath rest in your future kingdom. We recognize, Lord, that through all that, it's your part of your plan for us to serve you and serve others, to be good stewards of your grace in serving others. And we know that you guide us to do your will. You provide all we need for doing your will. So I pray as we consider the work that you have marked out for us, we would run our race with perseverance. We would draw on your grace. We would be able to have your spirit energize us with joy, in the midst of difficult trials and curveballs and disappointments. And we would do our work as a means of glorifying you, knowing that that's your plan. We also know that you'll reward us for doing that. So I pray that you would align our emotions, motivations with your perfect will. We ask this for our benefit in Christ's name. Amen.